You're listening to the Empty Stringers podcast, where every week we talk about locating, catching, and the conservation of redfish. My hope is to share with you what I'm seeing from the polling platform so that together we can catch more fish. Think of it as your weekly fishing report. Welcome back to the podcast, folks. I'm your host, Matt Parrish, and if you can tell, my voice is a little nasally. It's because I went and got pollinated today. I worked in the yard, and Mother Nature pollinated me while I was there, and so that's why I sound this way. We are well into March, and as predicted, the fishing is starting to pick up. The fish are starting to move into the back areas. We had a water dump this past week, past weekend. And even right now, I look today, this morning on a low tide, water level was at 0.2, which is pretty low. And then on a high tide this evening, we had an incoming tide all day long. That incoming tide pumped the water up to about a foot and a half. So decent tide swing. It's moving water, pushing all this bait that's starting to hatch out. When I was out last week, just about everything went wrong on my boat. I ended up going by myself. My kids bailed on me. And I asked Chris at the last minute. He was busy moving. And so I just went out on my own. And wind forecast was way higher than they said it was going to be. My power pole quit working. And I broke. I didn't break. But the push-pull holder on my platform broke. That's the fourth push-pull holder I've been through. And I know other guys are having trouble with them too. So I'm going to actually warranty this one and send it back in or do whatever I got to do to take a picture of it or whatever. But that's the worst made thing. It's from, what the heck is the name of it? V-Marine. It's from V-Marine. And I'm sure they're great dudes, but that is a crappy product. And I hate to say that, but it just is. I'm gonna, you know, get a new one, but there's got to be a better design for that deal. It shears off and just the base is left every time. So I have another one already. I'm gonna put it on and then I'm gonna try to get the one that broke warrantied. But so I was dealing with that. I noticed a couple things. I ran up really, really, really shallow and I spooked two fish as soon as I got in there. I would have eased in, but it was just too shallow to putt. It was even it's even too shallow to pole. But I spooked two redfish and could not help myself, and I shut it down in an area I probably shouldn't have shut it down in because it was like 3 inches deep, 4 inches deep maybe. But the tide was coming in, and I sat there for a minute, watched those fish, tried to get some casts on them, but I spooked them off pretty good. When the second fish spooked, I spooked the first fish when I was running in. When I sat down and stopped and looked around, and I pushed it. I got up on the platform, pushed it through the mud a little ways, and I spooked another fish right out in the middle of the lake. And when he spooked off, about 500 teeny tiny shrimp splattered everywhere. And that's what I've been waiting on. That's what I've been waiting to see. The shrimp hatch has begun. It's slow at first. It will begin to get more in numbers, and then those hatches that hatched early will start to get big enough for the redfish to feed on. And when that happens, it's going to be on. So what's going to happen now, until we see schooling fish, the crawlers are going to come out. Those redfish are going to be crawling in ultra shallow water. They're going to be moving really slow. 3-4 inches of water with their backs out. They're cruising. They're sucking up as many of those little shrimp as they can. So look for that. Now is the time to fish ultra shallow early in the morning. Usually around, 10 a.m. or so for some reason. And this isn't a tried and true thing. I've just noticed in my area, around about 10 a.m., those crawlers fall back off into a little bit deeper water. And in deeper water, I mean like they're in a foot, foot and a half, 2 feet. You can find those fish up shallow early in the morning. Now, if the wind's blowing like crazy, like it's going to be doing almost every day here pretty soon, it's going to be tough. That kind of action doesn't seem to happen as much or be as easy to spot when the wind is howling, but they're going to be there, so you can look for them. We caught the fish we caught in the GRS tournament a couple weeks ago. It was crawling in that shallow water. So look for those. What do you throw at a fish like that? Don't throw your quarter ounce jig head with, you know, a big old huge paddle tail on it. I'll tell you what I throw. If I'm going to throw a paddle tail, I throw a 3/16 jig head. I throw a small paddle tail, 3 inch, 3 1/4. And I throw it well past that fish and I swim it right in front of his face and I don't stop. Kind of slow to medium. That will usually trigger a strike. If not, you can slow hop it in front of him, you know, do all the things we've talked about, but don't splash that thing in 3 inches of water right in front of that fish's face. He is being stealthy and moving slow, and he is hunting. And you don't want, if you were out hunting, you wouldn't want an 8-point buck trying to crawl in your stand, right? So don't plop your lure right in front of his face. You're going to scare him off. You got to throw past him. Okay. And then, you know, this time of year out in the drains, it's all about the stuff we've been talking about, but to get more specific about the be same, but be different. Okay. So be same, but be different. Match the hatch, throw something small, shiny, you know, a color that's more natural. If you can't get a hit doing that, throw something weird. Throw something that looks different. Throw a topwater, throw a weird-looking bugs jig, something like that. That will oftentimes do it if the match the hatch just isn't working out for you. So if you're going to throw a topwater, let's talk about knots. Everybody thinks you have to tie a loop knot if you're going to throw a topwater. That just isn't true. It's not. So this episode is all about being a minimalist. Not because I necessarily think that that's what you should be, but that's what I am. And I think it serves me well. And anglers that are not minimalist end up carrying 7 rods with them and they only throw 1 or 2. They end up carrying 2 tackle boxes full of crap that they're not going to throw. And that's wasted space and it's wasted time. So what you really need on your boat, I told you last time, I've got 3 rods. Plus my fly rod. I bring my fly rod just in case the situation presents itself. But I've got the normal paddle tail. I've got the weedless paddle tail. And I've got the topwater. I do not tie a loop knot on my topwater. The only time I tie a loop knot is on my fly. And I only do that because everyone told me I had to. The point of the loop knot is to allow the bait to have free motion. So what I want you to do, pick whatever knot you're going to tie. Polymer, your knot of 1,000 names, as I like to call it, is basically a noose. They call it a fishing knot. They call it a clinch knot, improved clinch, whatever. You can tie that knot, and braid is slippery, okay? Tie that knot, or a polymer or whatever, grab a hold of that topwater once you cinch the knot down and take and wiggle the topwater in one hand and the line in the other and create that slide and that looseness your top water is going to work just as well as it would if you tied a loop knot. I don't necessarily have anything against tying a loop knot, other than the fact that I get annoyed with how the inconsistency of my ability to make my loop a certain size every time. So my loop ends up being big one time and ends up being small the next time. Maybe I just need to get better at it, but there's just no need to be able to tie it. I mean, you only need 2 or 3 knots in your arsenal, and you're only going to use one of those most of the time. If I'm throwing a jig head of any kind, I'm tying a polymer knot. If I'm throwing a hard bait and I just feel like bringing that around all those treble hooks, I'll still tie a polymer because I feel like it's the strongest knot that I tie. But if I decide I'm going to tie a loop knot or, you know, a clinch knot, I'll do those. Those are my 3 knots I know how to tie. There are a few others I know how to tie, but those are the ones I'm good at, I'm consistent at, and they're all you really need. You don't need to tie and learn how to tie all of them. If you just want to be an expert in knot tying, that's cool, but it's unnecessary. You know how to tie your boat off with a rope and a cleat. That's a basic, you know, knowledge that you know. So you got 3 rods. I got a fly rod for extra. I've got 1 little tackle sack that's got 1 box of jig heads and bugs jigs, another box of hard baits. It's got a rattle trap, 1 rattle trap, 2 top waters, a wake bait, and a crank bait. That's it. And then the rest of my bag has a pair of pliers. It has several bags of paddle tails. And I've got my little fly, black fly kit that my buddy Paul gave me. So that's really it. I mean, I don't even have braid snippet cutters. Listen, if you can't use your pocket knife to cut your braid, your pocket knife is too dull. It just is. Sharpen your knife. I don't have any trouble at all. You say, well, Matt, I cut the line and then I've got that little bit of knotted piece on the hook and I have a hard time getting it off. Your knife's not sharp enough. It comes off easy with my pocket knife. Now, when I start to have trouble, I know I need to sharpen my knife, but it also depends. I mean, get you a decent knife. I got Gerber knives. I like those because they seem to hold up pretty well, but I have to sharpen them more. I have a case pocket knife. I have 2 case pocket knives. One I had when I was a kid. I've had it forever. And then one I got recently. Both are the sharpest knives I've ever owned, and they hold their edge a lot longer than the Gerber. But I like the Gerber. I like the grips and the looks of those. They're cool knives. Those 2 keep a sharp edge on it. And you don't need to carry all that stuff because you're going to carry a knife anyway, right? Like a grown man's got a knife in his pocket 95% of the time. So why add something else you got to carry? I have a normal pair of pliers, you know, fishing pliers, and I have fish grips. And Chris likes to bring his boga. The only reason I like a boga is to weigh a fish. I don't like them to land a fish. I like to land the fish with the fish grips or with just my hand. But that's really it. I'm not carrying a bunch of stuff. I have 1 little small setup. And the people that will have a ton of stuff that they bring, I just don't ever see them use it. I mean, I've fished with a lot of people. And most of the guys that show up with a ton of stuff, they throw the 1 bait all day and never change. And we catch plenty of redfish. So just a thought, you know. Also, a lot of you are overthinking this redfish thing. The number one thing that you need to get good at to become a good red fisherman is to key in on figuring out where they're going to be. If you can just figure out where they're going to be, catching them is not that hard. You could put, I had a guy last year, my buddy Cody, throwing rooster tails at him. I've seen him caught on spinnerbaits for bass. I've seen him caught on all kinds of stuff. So the catching them is not that hard. Can they be finicky and spooky? Yes, absolutely. There are days when you got to pry their mouth open and force feed them. But people try to get too over the top with, well, what color this and what presentation here and should I do an underspin or not? Or should I do a this or that? Or what knot should I tie? Stop all that. Just figure out how to find the fish and how to cast at them. And that's your key. And to figure out how to find the fish, you have to get really good at knowing your area and what the tide does to your area, because you need to know where you can go and where you can't. Because if you know where you can go, then you might have a clue as to where the fish can and can't go. And then you need to know what they're eating in the different seasons of the year. And hopefully, listening to this podcast for the little, well, I guess we're rolling up on, well, I guess we're about a year and a half. If you've been listening for that long, then you know what they're eating during every season of the year, because I've told you. And so right now, if you're going to go out and fish, it's shad, it's glass minnows, it's crab are starting to hatch. Crab are probably going to hatch. They haven't hatched right now. They're probably going to hatch mid-April, I would guess. But we've got shad starting to hatch. We've got glass minnows. We've got the shrimp that just popped off. And we're going to see schooling fish soon. I haven't been out this week to check, and it's going to rain all day tomorrow, so I'm working all day tomorrow at the Baytown house, but I'll be out Friday, and we're going to see what it looks like there. We got a decently windy day. We'll see what's going to happen with that deal. The spring is going to involve the wind affecting the tide in big ways, and we will revisit that topic once it begins to occur. Right now, it's just all about getting out there and going up shallow, starting as shallow as you can and working yourself back to deep water. If you haven't been out in a while, you're one of those guys that you get to go out, you know, once a month or so. I'm going to tell you, if this is your weekend coming up, okay, we have a front and some storms that blew through this week. The storms are coming tomorrow. We've had a front. We'll be a little bit on the warming trend, but water temps are going to be in the high 60s when you launch on Saturday. And here's what I would do. I would pick, you're most likely going to have an incoming tide all day. I haven't looked at what the tide's going to do on Saturday, but I'm guessing the low is going to happen early in the morning. The tide's going to come in most of the day. What I would do is I would go to a place that's familiar to you and pick a marsh, go up into that marsh until you're in about 8 inches of water, and then look around, look for a current rushing through certain cuts, look at little back lake pockets that are fed with a strong current, and watch. Look for those wakes, those redfish wakes. Look for the swirls. Make sure you're not looking at mullet. Mullet give you that little V-shaped darting wake. A redfish in really shallow water like that will give you a somewhat slow U-shaped wake. Look like a submarine underneath there, you know, moving along. Look for that kind of stuff, the tail swirls, that kind of deal. You have some of these ultra shallow places are packed full of mullet, or they're packed full of infant or juvenile gaff top. And so if you get into that, the juvenile gaff top, just push on past those. I mean, just try to find another area. I don't usually catch a lot of redfish around those, but you'll notice that they make a lot of, how best to describe it? It looks a little bit like a trout eat that they make on the water. But you'll know it's not a trout eat because you'll be in 6 inches to a foot of water and you can just tell. after you've seen it enough. So keep your eyes peeled on that. And if that happens in your area, go to a different area. Start up there shallow and then work your way out slowly. And when you're fishing, you're pushing against the tide, but you're throwing your lure out and reeling it with the tide. That is the way that I would fish it on Saturday. And the marsh is starting to come alive. You should be seeing belly crawling redfish up shallow. If you're moving slow and quiet and steady, if you're not, you should see some bait popping and showering out near the pinch points, the drains, the inlets where the tide is rushing in. So that's what Saturday is going to be about. Pick that area, start as shallow as you can, and start working your way out to the edges. Unless you can get all the way back somewhere, and then I just, you know, comb around those backwaters as the tide is coming up, and those fish are going to be moving in, and they're going to be staying there all day long. So, you know, it's the time of year to get up shallow. If you get up shallow and you're not catching anything, don't, if you're in a kayak, I get you can't just pick up and burn off somewhere else, but work your way closer to the edges, because what happens sometimes during this time of year and then during the late fall is, you know, the water just dropped out. And even though our high tide is filling up some of the back areas, it's dropping back out again overnight. So if you think about that from a redfish's perspective, if I'm a redfish, am I going to, over an 8-hour incoming period, work my way all the way back, let's say a couple of miles to the back of this marsh, and then when the tide falls overnight and I'm left, you know, with 4 inches of water, am I going to then swim all the way back out to the deeper water another couple miles? Am I going to do that over and over again every day? And some redfish will, but not in high numbers. That 1.46, I think is what it was. It was around a foot and a half that was on the high tide water level MLLW today. That's not enough to completely fill the back legs up long enough to make it a viable habitat for the redfish to stay back there all the time. Now, if you find the place where it's closest to there, that's deep enough. And I'm not talking about a little 3-foot spot that's an indentation that's deep. I'm talking about find you a back lake that is deep enough, and a back lake that they can hold in, and then that they can move up in on the high tide and hunt in those back areas. So if you're fishing a falling tide, stay in the mouth and around the edges of that lake that's holding consistent water levels. Consistent water levels, meaning at a low tide, a fish can live there. And the way I judge that is you need 6 to 8 inches consistently in a back lake for a redfish to be able to stay there. Okay. If you have added structure to that, even better. At this time of year, water temperatures and all that are fine for them to stay there. They'll huddle up. They'll sit down in the mud. They'll sit down in a prop track. They'll nestle up against the grass. They'll sit down in a little creek bed feeding that back lake, and they'll hold when the water gets super shallow, and at the tide change or at daylight or whenever the major or minor is, they'll really come alive and they'll start to feed. And so find that area in the places that you like to fish that's holding a 6 to 8 inches of water on a really low tide, and it's getting up to a foot to a foot and a half on a high tide, and then look for bait. So your bait's going to really be showing up in areas that have good tide flow. We don't fish areas that don't get good tide flow. That's a good way to just enter no man's land. So Be looking for those solid tidal influxes. Find an area of stable water level and work your way out from there. Be just like the redfish. You start in that area. If the tide is high, you move up into the shallower areas. Or if you know the tide is high enough for you to get back there, just zoom on past it and work your way back to that lake as the tide falls. So that's kind of the rundown of an incoming and an outcoming and the way I try to plan things. Obviously, the sun and the wind play a factor. But what I like to do is I go, okay, I've got places like that in all these different areas. Depending on the wind, we'll decide where I'm going to go fish that day. If I got a, you know, I'm not going to tell you all my places, but you know, if I've got the wind this time of year at blowing 15 miles an hour, it dictates where I go. So that's why you want to explore several different areas and get comfortable with them. And if you're the guy that's going out once a month, I would say you need to learn that you need to pick that area that you're comfortable with and that you know really, really well. Okay. Get to know that area in all seasons and then pick out a different area. Learn that area in all seasons. Doesn't mean you have to go there every time, but get you two or three places like that. And then you're going to have the variety to go, okay, the wind's blowing 18 miles an hour today. I'm in my kayak. I'm going to go to, you know, Highland Bayou because I know that I can handle a northwest wind there. Or, you know, I'm going to go to launch over on the south shoreline because I've got a southeast wind and I know exactly where I can go to hide from that. And you take that piece of the puzzle and marry it up with all the other things we just talked about, the bait, the water level, the tide, all the stuff, and you can start to become consistently successful. And then once you see what the redfish are doing when you're out there and how you caught them, the next time you're out, you go check that first and then you branch out from there. And that's how you learn the deal. So I hope that you guys get out and get a chance to fish this weekend. I think the weather is going to be really pretty this weekend and then all through next week. And I'm trying to get as much work done on the Baytown house as possible so that I have more time to fish. I'm getting really close. My buddy, Ellis, who's a listener of the podcast, he is my plumber. And I blew him up with plumbing questions today because I look like a, you know, a roofer going in to do open heart surgery on someone. I just don't know anything about plumbing. So he helped me out. I'm going to hopefully knock out a bunch of that stuff tomorrow. And then again on Monday and Tuesday next week, and then try to take advantage of some of the beautiful weather we're going to have. So that's it. Let's get into our Bible tidbit. I told y'all last week we're going to do our Bible tidbit on Lot. There's a lot to be said about Lot, no pun intended. We are going to talk about the story. It's really the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and God destroying those cities and Lot living in those cities. And God sends, if you want to read this account, it's in Genesis chapter 19. I'm not going to read the whole story to you. Basically, God sends two angels that look like men, which if we go back to our angel talk about a month ago, then that marries up with what we talked about, right? Angels look more like men. They don't. Anyway, I'm getting way off. Go back and listen to that one. So these two angels look like men. They show up at the town gate and Lot is sitting there. Lot invites them home. They say, hey, we're going to stay in the town square. Lot's like, no, 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 you don't want to do that. Come home to my house. Because he knew what was going to happen to him if they stayed there. They come home to his house, and all of the people that live in the city know that Lot has taken in these guests, and they surround his house and beat on his door and want Lot to send these two guys out so that they can rape them. Now, you may be like, whoa, that is super weird. Yeah, it's weird and wicked. This is a wicked place. Lot says to them, hey, please don't do that. These are my guests. And I don't know if Lot had a sense about him that these were supernatural beings. I don't know. But he does something that is unthinkable to me. He says, hey, I have two daughters here that have, they're virgins, and I will send them out. You do to them as you wish. What? Like, no, I am not doing that. Like, I just can't imagine that. And the Bible never really explains that to us. And there's a lot of things in the Bible like that that don't really get explained. They're just stated. The Bible doesn't endorse it as right or wrong. It just says, this happened. That is obviously, the whole situation's messed up. Well, the angels strike the crowd with blindness, and they can't see. And so it keeps anyone from getting, you know, hurt in that situation. And the angels tell Lot, look, God is about to destroy this city. Get your wife and daughters and get out of here. So they plan to leave the next morning. The next morning, the angels say, hey, get up, grab your stuff, let's go. But in verse 15, it says, no, sorry, in verse 16, I'll read verse 15. It says, as morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. Verse 16, but he lingered. He was dilly-dallying around, didn't seem like he wanted to leave his home, which I get it, it's a big deal. Pack up and leave your house, never to come back. So the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him and set him outside the city. So, interesting point here, and a big part of just biblical hermeneutics is this word merciful. I think one of the very first Bible tidbits I did way back in the beginning was on this. I can't remember. This is the first time in the Bible that the word mercy or merciful is being used. And there is a biblical principle that when a word is used like this for the first time in Scripture, it helps define its meaning in the totality of Scripture. And in this situation, Lot is lingering, not wanting to do what God told him to do, and God had mercy on him and had the angels drag him out of the city to safety. Now, to me, the beautiful thing about that is that I have been Lot so many times. There's been so many times where I have been not doing what God wants me to do, lingering in my own sin for whatever the reason is, and God has mercy on me and drags me out of it. Sometimes that's painful, but it's God's mercy nonetheless. God saved Lot out of the city before he destroyed it. And so God pulling us out of something that we don't even want to necessarily come out of, but that we know is right and we know is what will please the Lord. God drug him out of the city, and God has drug me out of my own sin and bad habits and all of those things. And so when you think of mercy, I want you to think of it in the way of God basically dragging someone to safety against their will. I think it's a beautiful picture of mercy. So that is our Bible tidbit for the week. If you would like to get a hold of me, emptystringers@gmail.com. I'm on Instagram at empty_stringers, and I'm on the TikToks at emptystringers. And if you are going to go on the Matagorda Island trip in your kayak or your boat, Salty Yak Outdoor Podcast, Carrie Beeson just put out a great podcast on all the things you need to be aware of if you're going to go on that trip. Other than that, I've been listening to Meat Eater. I listen to Bite Me every week. I'll be down in Port O'Connor just before the Matagorda Island trip, hanging out with Scott. And I plan on sweet talking him into being a guest on the podcast. So we will see if that works out in my favor or not. So hope you guys have a great week, and go out and catch some fish this weekend. Shoot me a message and let me know what you saw out there. Talk to you later.